Shila Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Maharaj Shila Prabhupada Ki Jai Om Vishnu Pada Paramahansa Paravajakacharya Asakata Sata Sri Shilad Shila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj Shila Prabhupada Ki Ananta Goti Vaishnava Vindaki Namacharya Sri Haridas Thakur Ki Prem Chikahu Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasudeva Gauravata Vindaki Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shyamakunda Radhakunda Giri Govardhan Ki Vrindavan Dham Kija, Mayapur Dham Kija, Jagannath Puri Dham Kija, Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda Kija, Gaur Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru Gauranga. All glories to Shri Guru. Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 8, entitled Markandeya's Prayers to Narayan Rishi. And we are up to text 12. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Brahma Bhrigur Bhavo Daksho. Brahma Putras Chaye Pare. Nui Deva Pitri Bhutani. Tena san ati vishmitaha. Brahma brigur bhavo daksho. Brahma putras chaye pare. Nui deva pitri bhutani. Tena san ati vishmitaha. Please chant. Just a little bit. Brahma. Lord Brahma.
Bhrigu.
Bhrigu Muni. Bhava.
Lord Shiva.
Daksha. Pajapati Daksha.
Brahmaputra.
The great sons of Brahma. Cha and Ye, Hu, Apare, others, Rui, human beings, Deva, demigods, Pitri, forefathers, Bhutani, and ghostly spirits, Tena, with that conquest of death, Asan, they all became Ati Vishmita, extremely amazed. Translation by Disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Lord Brahma, Bhrigu Muni, Lord Shiva, Prajapati Daksha, the great sons of Brahma, and many others among the human beings, demigods, forefathers, and ghostly spirits, all were astonished by the achievement of Markandeya Rishi. Please repeat after me. Lord Brahma, Bhrigu Muni, Lord Shiva, Prajapati Daksha, the great sons of Brahma, and many others among the human beings, demigods, forefathers, and ghostly spirits, all were astonished by the achievement of Markandeya Rishi. So we are reading many more verses, and none have a purport. So we're going up to text 20 through text 27.
Wow.
So we can read the Sanskrit together. Itiham
brahmatam tapasadhyaya samyate tatva adoksham yogi dasa kleshantaratma.
In this way, the devotional mystic Markandeya maintained rigid celibacy through penance, study of the Vedas, and self-discipline. With his mind thus free from all disturbances, he turned it inward and meditated on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who lies beyond the material senses. Text 14. While the mystic sage thus concentrated his mind by powerful yoga practice, the tremendous period of six lifetimes of Manu passed by. Text 15. O Brahmana, during the seventh reign of Manu, the current age, Lord Indra came to know of Markandeya's austerities and became fearful of his growing mystic potency. Thus, he tried to impede the sage's penance. 16. To ruin the sage's spiritual practice, Lord Indra sent Cupid, beautiful celestial singers, dancing girls, the season of spring, and sandalwood-scented breeze from the Malaya hills, along with greed and intoxication personified. Text 17.
Devanat asmam jagmur,
O most powerful Sharnaka, they went to Markandeya's hermitage on the northern side, on the northern side of the Himalaya Mountains, where the Pushpabhadra River passes by the famous peak Chitra. The text 18 to 20. Tadashama padam punam punasuma adashtam punatiya palakirnam punyama jalashanam mata brahmat. Mata brahma asangitam mata kopiya kuchitam mata bari natata. Groves of pious trees decorated the holy ashram of Markandeya Rishi, and many saintly brahmanas lived there, enjoying the abundant, pure, sacred ponds. The ashram resounded with the buzzing of intoxicated bees and the cooing of excited cuckoos, while jubilant peacocks danced about. Indeed, many families of maddened birds crowded that hermitage. The springtime breeze sent by Lord Indra entered there, carrying cooling drops of spray from nearby waterfalls. Fragrant from the embrace of forest flowers, that breeze entered the hermitage and began evoking the lusty spirit of Cupid. Text 21. Springtime then appeared in Markandeya's ashram. Indeed, the evening sky, glowing with the light of the rising moon, became the very face of spring, and sprouts and fresh blooms virtually covered the multitude of trees and creepers. Text 22. Cupid, the master of many of heavenly women, then came there holding his bow and arrows. He was followed by a group of Gandharvas playing musical instruments and singing. Text 23. These servants of Indra found the sage sitting in meditation, having just offered his prescribed oblations into the sacrificial fire. His eyes closed in trance, he seemed invincible, like fire personified. Text 24. The women danced before the sage, and the celestial singers sang to the charming accompaniment of drums, cymbals, and venas. Text 25. While the son of passion, brackets greed personified, Spring and the other servants of Indra all tried to agitate Markandeya's mind, Cupid drew his five-headed arrow and fixed it upon his bow. Text 26 and 27. Text Sita Krishna Sita Shraja Itastato Vama Vishka Chalapasa Ayupantukam Vaya Jahara Tatpasa Shushalam Tita Ekam. The Apsara Punjikastali made a show of playing with a number of toy balls. Her waist seemed weighted down by her heavy breast, and the wreath of flowers in her hair became disheveled. As she ran about after the balls, glancing here and there, the belt of her thin garment loosened, and suddenly the wind blew her clothes away. So, just to have the spoiler, Markandeya still does not fall down, just so you know. It's in the next couple of verses. So, I think you all got the gist of this, but just to make sure that we're all on the same page. So, Lord Indra is trying in many ways to agitate Markandeya to the point that he falls down, which he doesn't do. But the first thing that's most astounding, it was mentioned in the previous verse, actually, about this incredibly long life of Markandeya. Now, I'm not a scholar, so I'm going to ask the scholars who are here. Markandeya does have the longest life of anyone in the Bhagavatam, is that correct? Lord Brahma.
Maybe.
Maybe, that's the answer. Okay. Who?
Durvasa.
Durvasa
Muni. Durvasa million years back.
Right.
Of course, this is a 2 billion plus.
So yeah, 2 billion plus.
Maybe.
Yeah, anyway, it's pretty incredible.
More than 2 billion.
More than 2 billion years, yeah. So, but it was saying here that even Lord Brahma, as well as several sages are mentioned, how they're all astounded by the, you know, achievement of Markandeya Rishi. So, it is pretty astounding. And then there was, so his successful method of meditation is to meditate upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is true for all of us as well. Because my first reaction to hearing this part of the story was that performing austerities and penances, as much as there are many devotees who do perform penances and austerities, and even just living in the material world is an austerity, but when we actually, you know, consciously perform austerities for Krishna, really, I mean, the only conclusion I can come to is we don't personally have any potency, but it's through our spiritual master, through Srila Prabhupada, who's our Shiksha, Diksha Guru. That's where, if we have any potency at all, it is to the credit of Srila Prabhupada. But these many verses have some beautiful descriptions of the ashram that Markandeya Rishi is living in, and then what Lord Indra, who is out to create his fall down, is attempting to create a fall down, and he's doing that by sending Cupid, among other methods. And I was, I went to our online resource, Wikipedia, to check out the description of Cupid, because it's just reminded me of like Roman mythology, and Greek mythology also has Cupid with a different name, but this is the description I got. It's just that how is it that the Greeks and Romans basically stole this concept from the Vedas, and they don't give credit. This is what I see. Although when I was reading some descriptions, they were saying like it's unknown, some area, you know, like who was the father of Cupid. But in any case, because the description of Cupid in these verses and in other parts of the Bhagavatam, because Prabhupada, there was over 600 references to Cupid in the Vedabase. But it's not only the name Cupid that Prabhupada is using, but that he's described as having bow and arrows as his weapon of, you know, inflicting lust on people. So, anyway, this is the description of Cupid. He's the ancient Roman god of love in all its varieties, the counterpart of the Greek god Eros, and the equivalent of Amor in Latin poetry. According to myth, see, they're I'm just pointing out where they're like not really getting it, where this ultimately comes from, the Vedas. According to myth, Cupid was the son of Mercury, the winged messenger of the gods, and Venus, the goddess of love. He often appeared as the winged infant carrying a bow and a quiver of arrows, whose wounds inspired love or passion in his every victim. It was the Greek god that they said they didn't really know who his parents were. But here's some other quotes from Srila Prabhupada describing Cupid. He said, Cupid's business, this is from the first canto, 11th chapter, 36th verse, purport. Cupid's business is to invoke mundane lust. The whole universe is moving, being agitated by Cupid's arrow. Cupid throws his arrow upon the living beings to make them mad after the opposite sex, whether their party is actually beautiful or not. And in that description, it goes on about even among animals, even ugly animals, Prabhupada was saying that the same thing happens. But there's one pastime concerning Lord Shiva. Prabhupada talked about in that same purport. And he said, Lord Shiva, who is considered to be most tolerant, was also struck by Cupid's arrow, because he also became mad after the Mohini incarnation of the Lord, as Krishna's only female incarnation. And he acknowledged himself to be defeated. Cupid, however, was himself captivated by the grave and exciting dealings of the goddess of fortune, and he voluntarily gave up his bow and arrow in a spirit of frustration. Such was the beauty and attraction of the queens of Lord Krishna. So, and then I also have, am I allowed to quote Shakespeare in a Srimad Bhagavatam class? Because there's a very famous quote from Shakespeare. Love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind. And therefore is winged Cupid painted blind. Very famous quote. I can't remember. I think it's from Midsummer Night's Dream. Okay, so
Lord Shiva burned into ashes because he made a man to be burned up immediately, but then he blessed him and gave him a subtle body so he can still do his service, but it's a subtle body.
Okay.
That's the
account. Okay, thank you. I have to admit that I am going to request that since I gave class last 1 year ago, I want to share with you several journeys that I have taken to India by way of Abu Dhabi. And also just last weekend, I was at the Prabhupada Festival in Los Angeles. So with your permission, can I share with you some things, okay, about my travels? Okay, well, before I went to India, I did my yearly journey to Wilmington, North Carolina to sell Christmas ornaments, which I think is a gas because I come from a Jewish background. I'm selling Christmas ornaments in a mall, and I'm a Hare Krishna. So there was once, many years ago, there was some somebody who was very upset with some of the vendors in the mall. This was at a different mall that I'm at now, but still, this lady was upset because she said, it's, you know, the Christian holiday. Like, why should there be a Chinese lady selling magic bamboo? And somebody, I think he was from Turkey, selling blankets, and an Indian lady selling purses, but she didn't know about me. So, anyway. So after my mall, I went to India, and that for me means going to Mayapur. I don't go anywhere else. So I took Etihad Airline, which stops in Abu Dhabi, because my daughter-in-law's parents have been living in Abu Dhabi for about 10 years. And I also, because I was on the same airline coming back, I also stopped there. And I stopped for like 2-3 days to recover from traveling. So I want to share with you about my admiration and total respect for the devotees in Abu Dhabi. So Abu Dhabi is in United Arab Emirates. Most of you have probably heard of Dubai, the more well-known city. Dubai is a city in United Arab Emirates, and so is Abu Dhabi. It's actually, Abu Dhabi is not only a city, it's also one of the seven emirates. And it's actually 3/4 of the country is Abu Dhabi, because it was the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi who created the country in the 1960s. Can't remember exactly what year. But it's a fairly new country, and both in Abu Dhabi and in Dubai, the very, very oil-rich people have built incredible buildings, and each one seems to try to outdo each other, and how different it is. The architecture is, like, you know, unbelievable. You just can't but strain your neck to take a look at the buildings as you're driving by. They're amazing. Anyway, my daughter-in-law's parents are both architects, but they're not involved with those buildings. My daughter-in-law's mother is building schools, so for the government. And so this is the thing. In many Indian devotees live in Abu Dhabi because if they've got a profession that is valuable in Abu Dhabi, then they get good jobs. They can't own anything. They can't get citizenship, but they can work there and make good money. So there's many devotees who live there, but it's very subdued as far as how they can express their religiosity. They can't have a temple. They can't do anything, you know, permanent. There is some kind of an Indian cultural center that they can rent a room when they really need a lot of space for the big festivals. There's also at least two different groups of devotees in Abu Dhabi based on their guru. So there's quite a large quantity of Jayapataka Maharaj disciples, and they kind of have one group. And then the second group is Mahavishnu Swami, the one who left his body, right? The elder Indian man, devotee who left his body. And then there's various other disciples. There's no Prabhupada disciples who live there. So my in-laws are disciples of Gopal Krishna Maharaj, so they kind of go to wherever they feel inspired to go. And usually it's to the group of Mahavishnu disciples. So they invited me to speak at one of the venues, and this particular family are kind of the leaders of that group. It was like going to a temple. I mean, it was their home, but these devotees have made their home a temple. And not only the leaders, but everybody in that community. That was what was so impressive to me, is that because they couldn't go to a temple, not just that they have deities on their altar, but they're like the level of commitment, of service to their deities. Like even my son's mother-in-law, she's working full-time. She has to be at work at something like 8:30 or something like that. But before she goes to work, she wants to chant all her rounds and cook an offering for her deities. And then her husband, who is sort of semi-retired, he's designing a new temple for the Vancouver Yatra, and doing other things. He was at one point in charge of the master plan for Mayapur. And Tama Harpo, you may know this, my in-laws, as the couple from Abu Dhabi. Right? That's how everybody knew them in Mayapur. But they're actually American and Canadian, dual citizenship. Anyway, he does the noon offering, and then I guess the mother-in-law, she cooks at night. This is just, one family, but they're all doing this. And it was like the level of time and commitment was impressive, but it was more of an understanding that our life is centered around our deity. That's how they viewed it. Like when I was congratulating them or encouraging them, they were like looking at me like, "Well, don't you do that?" No, like this is what it means to be a devotee. Anyway, I have an excuse that I've used for many years. Because the one coherent question I asked of Srila Prabhupada, and I'm sure I've shared this before, but I wanted I was identifying with a couple of ladies who were older. In other words, I was 29, and I was thinking I was older. And so, Prabhupada had given a deity right off his desk. Well, it was more of a dressed silver murti of Krishna that someone had given him, and he literally just handed it to Nandalal, who was probably in her 30s already, and he told her, "You make Krishna, your deity." And then I also knew this, and I knew her, and she had told me this story, but I also knew Chintamani, who had been married to Sudama, and he had taken sannyas. And then she had Jagannath deities, which had been on the altar when they were preaching in Japan. She helped open temples in the Far East. And when she left Japan, the devotees that insisted, "You take your deity with you." And she felt like it was installed and it should be staying there in the Japanese temple. And they said, no, it's your deity. And they insisted she take the deities. They were small. Jagannath Subhadraval. Twice she said she talked to Srila Prabhupada about her situation being a sannyasi widow, and he said to her, "Make Jagannath your husband, Balaram your son, and Subhadra your daughter." He told her that same thing on two different occasions. So I have this problem of sometimes thinking, because that happened to these devotees, I want to be in that same boat. And so I wanted to ask Srila Prabhupada, "Can I have my own deity?" But I couldn't ask it in that form. So what I asked was, "Can devotees have their own deities?" That was my question. And Prabhupada immediately said, "No. It will distract from the temple deities." So that's been my excuse of why I don't take care of my deities at home. Because I understood his point. I was a Brahmacharini at the time. It was time and circumstance. It isn't that Grihasthas shouldn't follow what it says in the Bhagavatam to make your home a temple. But I still, I've been hiding behind that. Anyway, to get on with my story. From Abu Dhabi, I went to India. I went to Mayapur, and the main thing I have to say about Mayapur is when you go to Mayapur, there's this feeling that the whole world has already become Krishna conscious. Because it seems like everybody on the planet comes to Mayapur. And I noticed this year was even more crowded than ever. Yeah, like seriously more crowded. It's been crowded, especially I'm going at Gorpranin time. It's crowded, but... So I'm not going to say more about Mayapur because I want to share about last weekend. It just so happened that I was in L.A. visiting my son and daughter-in-law and my two beautiful grandchildren on the same weekend. I was there for, it was a 10-day trip altogether, but it included one weekend, which was the Prabhupada Festival. So this year, they were the theme. Last year, it was Prabhupada's artists, Krishna art. And this year, the theme was cooking for Srila Prabhupada. And they had 7 people panel. Well, on Saturday, Shruti Kirti had the most time. He had like 45 minutes to talk, and then it was panel discussion and some questions, mostly from the Russian Yatra, who apparently sent a whole list of questions to be answered. But then they did take some from the audience. And on Sunday, it was Shruti Rupa, who now lives here, who had the 45-minute time slot before the panel. And she was very interesting because she was looking at the principles of cooking for Srila Prabhupada and then giving examples. And I think I remember the 4 principles because they're very similar to deity worship. Cleanliness, punctuality, quality, and not wasting. Those are the 4 principles of cooking for Srila Prabhupada. But anyway, it was very wonderful. It's all online. You can find it all that they said on YouTube. Okay? It's all there. I don't know if they have the cooking demonstrations they did afterwards, but the talks are all recorded and available. But they didn't ask people like me who never cooked a meal for Srila Prabhupada, but I was involved in a tiny way in cooking for Srila Prabhupada. So I wanted to share those pastimes. First of all, I was living in Mayapur from like November of 1975 until I think it was May of 77. And at first I was avoiding cooking in the kitchen. Somebody had told me, oh, get so dirty when you cook in the kitchen. And I was thinking, yeah, I don't want to get dirty. I don't know why. I avoided cooking. But then after some time, I was helping a very wonderful devotee named Vrindavan Biharini. She was cooking the evening offering for Radha Madhava. And Prabhupada told the devotees that Radha Madhava feast at night. So the biggest offering of the day is at 8:15 at night, bigger than the Raj Bhog offering. She had a standard of what was offered. It was 6 sweets, 2 of which had to be milk sweets, and 14 salty preparations. Yeah. And then there was standard, like there had to be puris, there had to be nimkis, there had to be a chutney. The funny thing was, there was no rice. Don't ask me why, because Bengalis are like, without rice, it's not a meal. But in any case, Lord Krishna is not Bengali, so. We made a lot of sabjis and so many salty, savories. So I learned how to make sandesh. And I mean, I could describe to you, I can literally tell you how to make sandesh, but it was, because she had it down to a science and she had learned it from another devotee named Sumuki who had looped, I think, years before. But Sumukhi had come up with this infallible way of making sandesh, and it didn't involve any machines. Like in the West, I think they tend to put things in food processors. But we would take enough for one ball of sandesh and knead it to the point that it covered like a 2-foot by 2-foot area on the marble slab. We would spread it out so thin with our hands and fingers just to get rid of any lumps. You know, that's the main thing. It had to be like entirely smooth. And then there's a science how to measure, you know, the sugar that you put in it and how to cook it just to the right point that the sugar melted, but just the right consistency. And so when Srila Prabhupada came to Mayapur, both in 76, January of 76, he came to Mayapur for 2 months, and in January of 77, the same, 2 months. So we would give the Maha Sandesh to Prabhupada's servant to keep for Srila Prabhupada, because early in the morning when he did his translation work, he sometimes, or maybe every day, I don't know, but he wanted a pickup, you know, something that would give him more strength early in the morning, and his preferred thing to eat was sandesh. So I indirectly, I cook for Srila Prabhupada the sandesh. So, okay, but I'm going to save another sandesh story for last. So while we were in the kitchen cooking this 8:15 offering, if Srila Prabhupada was hungry in the evening, then his cook, who was mostly, that I remember was Palika, who was in the Prabhupada Festival in L.A., amazingly enough. So Palika would come into the room right next to the Deity Kitchen. The Deity Kitchen at that time was on the first floor of the Lotus Building. And it wasn't a proper kitchen. It didn't have a sink. There was a faucet that came out from the wall, and there was a small drain below it, but basically the water just splashed on the floor. And there was no permanent anything in that room. Everything was just on tables, and we cooked with two coal stoves that's inside of a bucket. Like they fix a bucket up so that comes a coal stove, and one of the Bengali men would come in and start it up hours before we cooked, because it took hours, literally hours, for the coal to catch on fire and be hot. And we had to learn how to keep it going without smothering it and things like that. We also had a kerosene stove that we had to pump up. It was kind of dangerous. And finally, we had a very small but steady flame from the gober, the cow dung, that they would put in these huge containers that was behind the Lotus Building, which is now, they were where the courtyard is now. And just, I can't remember how many feet across. I mean, there were two huge, huge vats for the cow dung, and it produced one little flame. I don't think it was as efficient as it could be, but the flame was actually valuable to us as cooks, because we were also making the sweet rice for Mangal Arati, and like to have a slow, steady flame like that was perfect for sweet rice. We could just, you know, put the preparation on and not worry that it was going to burn. So all these things were on tables, and anyway, it was a functioning kitchen, but we worked on the floor. We didn't have countertops. And we were young, so we could deal with that. So what I remember one time is that Palika had been in Calcutta and had been staying with an Indian man named C.L. Bajoria. And she was mentioning him this weekend, how he was just, you know, wealth of wonderful recipes and willing to teach her and had high quality ingredients. And she had just learned how to make fresh pea kachoris from him. The kachoris are traditionally are made from dal. Excuse me, but she was using fresh peas. So she wanted to try it after learning from him. So she had come into our kitchen, and or maybe she was next door in Prabhupada's kitchen. But in any case, she was telling us what was going on. She was right there with us. And at some point, Prabhupada called for her. So she goes up to see what he wanted. She was still wearing her apron. So Prabhupada said, "Who are you cooking for?" She said, "Oh, I'm cooking for Radha Madhava. I'm making these fresh pea kachoris that I just learned from C.L. Bajoria." He said, "Well, when is the offering?" And she told him, "He will bring me some after the offering." So that was, she didn't mention this in her, you know, she said so many other stories, but I remember that and how Prabhupada ate so many of those kachoris. He really liked them. I remember the day of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's appearance day. His appearance, he was born on February 6th. I don't remember what year. But I always remember that because my own father was born and died on February 6th. So I'm always there in Mayapur for his appearance day. So at 6 o'clock in the morning on that day, I think it was 1976. Srila Prabhupada called Bhavananda into his room and was asking him about the plans for celebrating Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's appearance day. And Bhavananda hadn't planned anything. He told me about it, but I think he pretended like he had something planned. But Prabhupada said, "You have to offer 108 preparations." And he came out of that meeting with Srila Prabhupada. And, you know, I was somewhere chanting japa and some of the other ladies. And he just said to us, "You have to go in the kitchen right now and cook 108 preparations by noon." And I think that Vrindavan Biharini was in Calcutta at that time. So there was just Madhuri and me who were, you know, regularly cooking. And Madhuri was just the substitute for, anyway. We didn't have any boga. We didn't have any supplies to make so many preparations. And we told him so. And he didn't care. He said, "Just go to the big kitchen, get what you need." And then he also went to the big kitchen where all the Bengali ladies were cooking for all the devotees. And he told them to make as many preparations as possible too. Okay? Anyway, I won't go into all the details, but we made something like 25 preparations. That's all we could do. We weren't in that mood like sometimes we do in the West. They maybe make 10 types of halva or something and just put a different flavoring in each one. You know, we weren't into that. We were used to cooking elaborate preparations that take time and effort. And so we made 25 unique preparations, which was pretty good considering no preparation and starting at 6 in the morning. So Prabhupada had them bring the Mahaprasadam to him. And he tasted the different preparations, and he said he really liked the bindi preparation. So bindi is okra, right? We never could figure out who made, nobody had okra. Nobody remembered making okra. So we were all a little baffled by that. But in any case, the basic thing that he said was that the prasadam was wonderful. He loved it. And he asked Bhavananda who cooked. And he was mad at us, Madhuri and me, because we didn't cook 108 preps. So he just said the Bengali ladies cooked. So then he said, yes, they are so expert. I want the Western ladies to go and learn how to cook from the Bengali ladies. Learn the principles of Bengali cooking. Which was totally valid. It's just that, you know, he didn't give us any credit whatsoever. But so he must have tasted or might have tasted some of the cooking that I did that day. So that's what I'm saying. I've indirectly cooked for Srila Prabhupada. So, and then I remember a story about Pishima, who was always wanting to cook for Srila Prabhupada, but because he wasn't well in 1977, and they were very careful not to give him any ghee. They were making these paste masalas that didn't require ghee. You know, for Srila Prabhupada's health, they were keeping Pishima away. But she wanted to cook for Prabhupada, and Prabhupada knew this. So one night, he told his servant to tell Pishima, or maybe he called her up. I don't think he called her up there. But he asked that Pishima cook for him. So I was busy in the kitchen, but I know she had this bottle of mustard oil that she was just waiting to use it, right? Because to her, mustard oil is the only way to cook. And she cooked kach kela sabji. So this is green plantain. And it had so much mustard oil that I was always in the kitchen cleaning up when Papa would eat at night. His plate would come into the Didi kitchen, because his kitchen was right off of the Didi kitchen. And it was really hard to say whether Prabhupada even tasted it. You know, the bowl looked still full. And somehow on that night, I could have eaten as much of that Mahaprasadam as I wanted. Nobody was around somehow. Usually when Prabhupada's Maha came from his room, people just showed up out of the woodwork. But that particular day, no one was there. And we could have eaten it all. But it was so full of mustard oil that we couldn't eat it. And the Bengali men who were doing the 24-hour kirtan, they loved it. So it got honored. Definitely got honored. But Shuddha Kirti was telling about how there was such a commotion about the Maha, and it would take her so long to distribute it that Prabhupada told her to mix it. You've probably heard that Prabhupada had her mix the sweets and the salties and everything together. She said she would knead it till it was like completely mixed, and how each day when she would distribute the maha, there would be less and less people, to the point that nobody would show up. And she said she would eat it and relish it. Anyway, so my last story is how, because I knew how to cook sandesh, when Prabhupada left Mayapur in probably April of 77, March or April, like after the Gorpraneem festival, when he was so sick, but he felt a tiny bit better and said he would go to Bombay to the Pandal program. So that was the last time he left Mayapur. He went to Calcutta, and I went to Calcutta with Pishima because I was her servant. Brought her to Calcutta. So I was in the Calcutta temple, and I decided I would make some sandesh for Prabhupada. And I, you know, got some milk, made the curd, I, you know, drained the whey out, pressed the whey out, did the whole process, left the sandesh in the Didi kitchen, which I thought was a safe place, came back a couple of hours later, and it was gone. And I was devastated. I was just like so distraught. Couldn't believe somebody would take it. By that time it was evening, and a devotee named Sumana Devi Dasi, who has since left her body, very, very sweet Bengali lady, she was cooking the evening offering for the deities, and she had made some curd to put in the sabji. She insisted that I use that curd and make more sandesh, that would shorten the time because it was one major step along, right? She says, you know, like, for Prabhupada, it was for Prabhupada, do it for him, right? And I was, you know, okay, so I kneaded it again, you know, the way, you know, spread it out, with no lumps, and cooked it just right. And this time, when it was done, I found Prabhupada's servant, who was Navayogendra Das Brahmachari, who's now Swami. His Brahmachari servant, I gave it to him to make sure it was safe. So the next morning, I'm in the temple room chanting japa before Mangalarti. And Navayogendra, who never talked to women, except for service, right? But he was like one of these super strict brahmacharis. He came right up to me and he said, Mataji, Srila Prabhupada said your sandesh was very good. Perfection of my life. That's my glory story. That's why I saved it for last. Thank you so much for tolerating me. Hare Krishna. Any urgent questions or complaints or discussion or anything? Okay.
Thank you for a wonderful class. One question. I don't know how to say it. The other city, and how do you say it? Not Dubai, but the other.
Abu Dhabi.
Is it as developed as Dubai?
As what?
Is it as developed?
Yes.
It is.
It is.
I just was curious.
And last year when I went to India, I also stopped in Abu Dhabi, but for a shorter time, and I wasn't feeling well. But I went to the Grand Mosque. And actually, I wanted to share that last year when I gave class, because this is a newish building, like within the last 10 years. But it is like the main tourist place. And the walls reminded me of the Taj Mahal, where there's jewels inset in patterns in the walls, and there's lots of pillars and so on. But they did it, instead of by hand, the way they did the Taj Mahal, they did it using machines, like precise machines, and it's incredible. But the thing that's most impressive to me as a devotee, they insisted that every woman who goes in that mosque be covered from head to toe. Right? Like, I was covered as devotees, you know, but my arms are showing. Wouldn't let it pass. I had to wear to borrow one of their burqas. They had these nylon burqas that they, you know, if they didn't approve of the way you looked, you had to go and borrow one of their burqas. Yeah. Like, that is the standard that I was just impressed by their standard, that they enforced it. You know, how we have tried to sometimes enforce a standard, or at least communicate that we have a standard of dress code for our temple. But we never enforce, really. But they were. Anyway, Hare Krishna, more? How many devotees are in Abu Dhabi? A few hundred, I think. I think so, because I was in the smaller group gathering. And then Dubai has, I think, even more. Yeah. There's...
Yeah. Dubai, the Muslim government gave us big land. No?
They did? Tell that on the internet. You said, okay.
I don't know if it should be in public news, but Muslim government
Okay, so the latest news is that can't say it on the internet. Okay. Okay, by word of mouth we can say. Okay. Thank you all very much. It's 9 o'clock. Thank you for talking.